There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Stephen's Underground Garage's Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. In honor of the release of the David Bowie box set Brilliant Adventure, 1992 to 2001, we celebrated a David Bowie week in the Underground Garage. To cap off the festivities, I spoke with Mark Plotty, who produced the 2001 album Toy with Bowie, which features re-recordings of many of his 60s singles. It was never officially released until its appearance on the new box set. The album features our recent coolest song in the world, You've Got a Habit of Leaving. Let's hear some of that now, followed by my chat with producer Mark Plotty on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Manfred here, and it's time for today's Coolest Conversations. And joining me to cap off our David Bowie week in Little Stephen's Underground Garage is New York-based musician, record producer, and songwriter Mark Plotty. Together with Bowie, he produced the album Toy, which was intended for release back in 2001, but got shelved at the time. The version got leaked to the internet in 2011, but now it's being officially released, first as part of the Brilliant Adventure box sets, 1992 to 2001. The album also features our coolest song in the world this week, You've Got a Habit of Leaving. Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm good. Hey, how are you?
I'm hanging in there, man. My goodness. So how everybody's got a pandemic story. So real quick, how have you managed these past few months?
Oh, we're doing okay. You know, it's a bit of a challenge because we have remote learners. So last year was rough. But now everybody's back at school. Everybody's vaccinated or close to it, so we're okay. We're, you know, I feel like we're lucky in New York City because we seem to have it pretty together.
You know what, man? I was looking up your bio, and in the like '90s, you were working with such an array of artists from Suzanne Vega to Quincy Jones, Janet Jackson, Lou Reed, Nina Hagen, Delight. There's also this association with Philip Glass for like 10 years or so. What got you into recording, and how did that lead you to New York City?
Oh, it's a total accident. Like everything in life, it's just sort of a door opens and, hey, that's a door. You have to just kind of know to go with things, I guess. I would just see an opportunity and just try things. I got attracted to music as a kid, and I never thought I would do that as my life's work, but it just kind of turned out that way. as far as recording, a friend of mine was in a band and I went to see them record a demo. And I knew I was going to be in music somehow, but I didn't really know what capacity. So I went to the studio to watch them, and recording just really stuck with me. Like, wow, that's something I could do. I could, you know, both sides of this, like the musical side and the technical side. And, you know, you're just making something out of, you know, you're just pulling things out of thin air and making something. And that was always attractive to me. So it kind of didn't matter what I was doing. Like when I was at university, I'm recording orchestras, jazz ensembles. I go to New York, you know, I'm going to try to be like a rock and roll engineer, I suppose, and I end up doing dance music. And you just have to run with it and see it. I learned so much from doing dance music that I never could have anticipated. And it was all because, like, I, you know, it was an accident. They had an opening and I just happened to show up and I went with it. And I can say that about, I don't know, so many other things.
Well, you're credited with producing David Bowie's 1997 Earthling album, along with guitar player Reeves Gabrels. But how did you actually meet David, and how did you wind up working on that album?
Well, in the mid-90s, I had a pre-production room in Philip Glass's studio. I had kind of discovered that by accident. I was hired to do a mix there for a Columbia artist, and I showed up there and noticed that they had a window in their control room, which was really novel. Like, nobody had one. It was like 1991. And just to be able to, you know, look out the window and you see the Manhattan Bridge and the days changing. And that was, you know, something for us studio rats. That was really exceptional. So I remember this place. And then a couple years later, after I'd been working there a bit, bringing, you know, projects there, I had to move all my gear out of my house because I had a baby. We'd had a child. And so I asked them if there was a space for me there. And that's how I ended up there. Just and I was working the room a lot. Sometimes I work with Philip, most of the time bringing in my, you know, artist I was working with. And then David came one day because Philip had done his adaptation of David's Low album. And David and Reeves were looking for somewhere to work. They were working on a song, and they happened to come like the place. Since I was sort of the rock person in the orbit, I got to work with them, and I thought it would be, I guess, 1 week or so of just working on this one song, and turned into 7 years straight off of that.
Well, about this, you had mentioned working with the dance stuff, and now you've described yourself as being, you know, the rock guy in that orbit. Like, was David familiar with the fact that you had done all this sort of dance-oriented stuff, and was that like a plus to him about work skills?
I think he figured that out later. I don't think they really checked out who I was before that. I mean, before I met them, they really needed somebody to sort of, I was engineering and programming. So I really wasn't going to have too much artistic input from the get-go. I wasn't supposed to, but it turned out differently. And we just kind of all got in a room together and it clicked. That was the thing about it. You know, everything, like, we shared a musical sensibility, and I understood their sense of humor, and I don't know, we just got on a house on, like, we got on like a house on fire from the get-go. So much so that we got on like a house on fire kind of from the get-go, I'd say. So much so that he said to me at the end of that week, well, we're going to go do a summer tour, and when we come back, you know, we want to do an album here with you. Which I didn't believe, because I'd been in the industry long enough to know that, you know, people will say things, and, you know, just to be nice or whatever. So I didn't put much stock in it until they actually did come back, and we did start a record that became Earthling.
So Earthling comes out, and then there's this album Hours in 1999, and then there should have been Toy, but instead of coming out in 2001. There's this Heathens release in 2002. So this notion that Bowie has to revisit these old songs, is that something that scared the record company from releasing it? What do you think? Why did it get shelved?
Well, the thing about Toy was we did that record really fast. That was the idea of it, was to capture this moment, this performance. And he wanted it to be out there. He wanted it to be out there quickly, given the kind of record that was. And they just couldn't really do that. Record labels couldn't just throw things out in the ether like they do now. I mean, and David had some experience with him. Case in point, the very first song I did with him was a song called Telling Lies, which was, if I'm not mistaken, the first internet single. And so he understood that. I mean, he had a scary grasp of what the internet was going to be from those days. And he just wanted the record out, and they just couldn't really do it. And he'd moved on. We were already in kind of a different headspace because he'd started writing. We were doing a couple of new songs at the time. We were finishing Toy. So, and he was like that. He would be moving.
What prompted or inspired him to revisit these old songs for tour? What was the impetus to there? Because there were a couple of newer songs that he had that were recorded around that time intended to be on there. Why revisit this older stuff? Why come up with the pinups of himself, you know?
Yeah, I quite hadn't really put it in that light, but that's kind of true. Well, the idea of this record really sprung from doing this show called VH1 Storytellers in the fall of 1999. And for that show, David wanted to do a song from that era, a song from that period, so he could talk about it. And so they had to find one. And I think it was Reeves Gabrels that found this song called Can't Help Thinking About Me. He had it on a compilation album, I think. And so we decided to play that in the show, which was coincidentally my first gig in the band. I was just going to play with the band on that show, and typical of David, then I just didn't leave the band after that. and we did that song, and he just had a really good time doing it and sort of reconnecting with that. And he poked fun at the lyrics a little bit. You know, this is like his teenage self and whatnot. or close to teenage self. And he just really enjoyed it. So much so that we ended up playing it on the tour that followed that. And then we were in Ireland, and we had done this little show. After we'd done Wembley, we did a little show in Ireland, and Joe Elliott came backstage to visit after the gig, and he loved that song. He thought you guys really, you know, you killed that, and maybe you should do, you know, some more of those. And I'm not sure if that gave David the idea, or he was already thinking that, and maybe it was nice to hear somebody else say it too. But a couple months later, after we finished that tour, he said, you know, let's gather up a bunch of those songs and just record them, you know, as a band, which we did over the next couple of months. We kind of listened to songs and got them together and decided we're just going to make this, you know, we're going to do this quick record, you know, of us doing these songs all together. Because the earlier versions all had different producers, different studios, done at different times. And we thought it would be cool to do them all in one go with one band and to do it as live as possible. Which to me was a great idea, because after having performed with him, I noticed from watching him sing on stage, he just had a different energy singing on stage opposed to the studio, just really connecting to a song, on a different level. And I thought it would be really nice if we could get that, if we could catch that in the studio. Like, that would be the thing for me as producer person would be to try to get that, to get this immediacy, this sense of being in the song and this sense of fun. So that was really the impetus for doing this.
I'm glad you brought up Can't Help Thinking About Me, because that's the song I want us to go out on in a couple of minutes.
Oh, cool.
So this You know, I like the idea you're talking about when those songs were done back in the 60s. It was all these different places, different studios, and also this aspect of him sort of reconnecting with his teenage self, right? I mean, sort of revisiting that and sort of getting back into his own head and kind of, you know, in some instances, sort of making fun of himself, you know. But as you work specifically on these different songs, was there any guiding or overarching principle, or was it like, well, let's just evaluate each one of these songs first, you know, it's its own universe, and let's see what this song needs?
The idea with this was to let the band do what the band does. That was always something with David, was he would get people to do what they do and to bring what they bring, with him kind of guiding you sometimes or pulling something out of you that you didn't think you could do. But the idea was for him to, like, it's like being a casting director, to get these people together and catch their chemistry and what they bring to a song. So we decided we would do this with the band that was going to do Glastonbury Festival, which was an opportunity for us to play a few shows together, to get really, to get tighter together, and especially Glastonbury, which was a big moment for everybody. And so we were pretty tight and pretty together, you know, after Glastonbury. So after that, we came back to New York and started recording pretty straight off. With this one band and all that they brought to it. And that, I think, is really, that's so critical for this record, because in that sense, it's like an old school sort of band record where, we weren't writing the songs there, we weren't building the songs there, we were just playing the songs as a band. And we were very, you know, lucky that this band really clicked on so many nice levels, not musically, personally, everybody was in a great place, and David was in a great place, and it just all really kind of came together at that time.
Well, did the band continue to do any gigs together, that particular lineup, after the album was finished?
Yes, that band was a little bit smaller than the band that would follow. The band in 2000 was Sterling Campbell on drums, Gillian Dorsey on bass, Mike Garson on keys, Earl Slick on guitar. He had come back to the Bowie fold at that time, and I was playing guitar with him. And then on backing vocals, we had Holly Palmer and M. Greiner, and that was it. So we had a pretty straight up kind of two guitars, bass, you know, band, which was really great for those songs. And for that, just for that vibe, you know. But after that, we added another guitar player, and we got another keyboard player as well. So it just changed the band. It had more depth after that, but it wasn't the same as like this kind of, you know, little rock band.
Right. Well, so the album doesn't come out then, it gets shelved, but it does get leaked to the internet in 2011. Who leaked it?
I have no idea. I know. I don't know. I don't know what happened. It was something I didn't even want to listen to it, because I was really just, I didn't want it to come out like that. I mean, you know, it needed to have its moment. But so I didn't even look at it for a while. I didn't know what was in it, what order, what. And but it is, you know, some of it's out there. But it seems to me like just somebody found a CD of things we were working on at the time, because it didn't seem like anything's quite finished. And that's all I can think, really, that could have been the case.
So one of the tracks that's on that, the leaked version, is a version of Liza Jane, which was like David's first single. But that's not on the toy version. Is there a reason that it was left off? Was it, as you said, maybe half finished, or well?
No, we had a lot of songs, so it was sort of, you know, choosing a hierarchy of what would be like, you know, album sequence, and then, you know, extras for, you know, B-sides or what have you, just to, you know, as one complete kind of work. So Liza Jane will be coming out in the January box set, actually.
Right. Like that's a Rhino Records, I think Rhino Records has got something, a version of the toy coming out. I think it's a standalone album.
Yeah, in January.
The box set thing comes out later in November.
Yes, just the sort of proper album, because on the January 7th box, there's going to be alternates and acoustic mixes and stuff like that, little fun bits. But Liza Jane will be there. I bet that Liza Jane will be there.
As it should be. It's, you know, it's like they're at the first. It was at the beginning, so shall it be at the end.
And interesting about that, you say unfinished. It's we played Liza Jane exactly one time.
Oh, one take wonder.
Well, that was the thing about this record, was there was a lot of that. There was a lot of sort of, especially vocals, were just a one take go for him. He would do that anyway. You know, that was the thing about recording him when I started, was he was not one of these people that would do like five tracks of vocal and you'd go through and pick the best bits, which had become a pretty standard procedure. He was more of the old school, where he would sing the whole song, and he'd only stop if, you know, he messed up a word or wanted to change a word, something like that. So he blasted through these tunes on this session.
Well, our coolest song in the world this week is You've Got a Habit of Leaving. That was, Bowie's third single, came out in 65, actually before he took the name of Bowie, so Davy Jones at that time. Original was produced by Shel Talmy. He lives here in Los Angeles. Have you ever spoken with Shel? Ever come across him?
I haven't, actually.
Was there any
here's some stories.
Dissecting of the original song, You've Got a Habit of Leaving, and its arrangement, or what guided the new version? You kind of learned the chords and then you sort of just did it, or?
Pretty much. We were not out to recreate the version, the earlier versions. We take a couple of little motifs here or there, or but we would, again, we would do our own thing with it. You know, be kind of inspired by it, I suppose. Yeah, we, you know, do the basics, like you learn the chords and things, but it wasn't like we weren't trying to replicate, you know, to do them again. We're just doing them in the way that we all felt like doing them on that particular day.
Well, there is one elephant in the room here, one glaring thing that's not there. And I was going to want to ask you about this.
Tell me.
I didn't see any version of Laughing Gnome. He did not want to do Laughing Gnome. That never came up.
It never came up.
Oh, that's too bad. One of my, actually my very favorite early Bowie song is I Dig Everything.
Oh, really?
And I what I love about it is it's this, in some ways, it's almost a parody of a 60s band, even from then, right? It should have been on like an Austin Powers soundtrack, right? But but I do love the instrumentation and the hook. Everything is great. And also what I like about it is lyrically, it's kind of anti-60s in a way. You know, it's this character who digs everything and he's trying to be cool, but at the same time he's kind of getting misused by everybody around him, and it's not really clear if he realizes what's going on or not, but he's trying to keep this naivety, this grooviness happening, even though he's kind of on the downside of things. So did Bowie, when you guys were working on this, how did he see the contemporary version of the song different from the 60s version?
I don't know that we dug into it in that way. If he had, you know, feelings about, you know, how to, you know, address these lyrics 30 years later, I mean, I wasn't privy to them. It just seemed more like he had fun doing it. That was the thing about this record, was he just really enjoyed it. He, you know, revisiting this work, and in some ways, maybe we were all surprised at how, you know, how cool it really was. The thing about a song like, you know, a lot of these songs, like You've Got a Habit of Leaving Me, Karma Man, you already, you know, can tell what's going to happen. You can tell in his early writing that he's already breaking rules. That's from the outset. He's already trying to forge something that he feels like doing, and that became, you know, that became what he was. But, you know, as we all know him, you know, he would always just, you know, if you pursue something different each time, perhaps, which for me was a great thing about working with him, was that we would always do something different. It would always be, he would always change things. But this was going on very early on for him, and it was kind of cool to notice that.
Yeah. Well, another highlight for me is that version of "Let Me Sleep Beside You." And so the original I was told or read was that it was supposed to be like the first time he worked with Tony Visconti. Do you know if that's true?
I don't know that, actually. Yeah, some of my details about those times are a little sketchy. I knew a while back, but it's been so long now that I kind of consider these as the songs, you know. I haven't heard
any of them. Have you ever dealt
quite a while, you know?
Have you ever dealt with or worked with Tony yourself?
Sure.
And his what was his reaction, or did he have you ever spoken to him in the context of these songs or the album? Has he heard the releases?
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely. I mean, he was he did two fantastic string arrangements, which we did on the very last day of recording, for a song called Conversation Piece and for Silly Boy Blue. And that was one of the greatest sessions that I think I was a part of. String sessions are always great, but this was really, it was more than special. It not only put the, you know, the cherry on top for those particular songs, much more than that, they really just brought them to another level. But just having all these people in the room and watching them bounce off of each other, it was one of those sort of, for me, as a 70s kid, it was one of those pinch me moments where I'm in the room with, you know, Bowie, Visconti, Garson, and Slick. And I wonder, like, you know, how of these flashes of like, I don't belong here. You know, this is like too much greatness for me, you know, to sort of be around. But it was a wonderful day, that.
Well, I was wondering, you guys start working on these songs. Was there anyone that, do you recall if there was anyone that you guys had worked up that Bowie sort of turned around and said, oh, now I finally got this right. You know, I wasn't really satisfied with it before, but now I feel like the song is doing what it's supposed to do.
You mean as in like the 60s version versus the 2000 version?
Yeah, that somehow the revisit, he felt more satisfied with the revisit than he had with the initial recording.
I'm not really sure. I mean, they're all so different from the originals, and I don't know that there was something. The only one I would think would be a song called Hole in the Ground, which is really, like the original, is really kind of a fragment. And we did kind of make something out of that and make something pretty interesting out of that. It's actually one of my little favorites because it's just, you know, it's so different and unto itself. So that's something, we took it somewhere, no doubt, from the original. But I got all the others. I mean, they were just, you know, kind of new and cool versions of from where he'd started.
Well, the last track I want to ask you about, we mentioned earlier, Can't Help Thinking About Me. So this was the one that sort of provided the impetus to do the whole session. Am I remembering that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Did you start playing that song? Remind me again, what was it that got you doing that song?
Well, we started playing that song in the fall of 1999. He chose it to be on the VH1 Storytellers show. Yeah.
Well, do you know why he chose that song?
Yeah, we were looking for a song from that period, and it was Reeves that found it on a compilation album, and he just suggested that to David, and he goes, "Oh yeah, cool, that's a good, you know, good choice."
So that was a good choice. So if he at that point, you think if he had come up with "I Dig Everything," he may have gone for that, or was there something specific about "Can't Help Thinking About Myself"?
I don't know if there was anything specific about it. I think it just, you know, caught their fancy at that moment, which is so much of how all this works, you know, just what gets you at the time.
Right. But I bet if Reeves had said, "Hey, why don't we work up the Laughing Gnome?" it wouldn't have come together.
That one, I don't think so. I don't quite see it.
No.
I don't.
Well, that's for the next box set, you know, dig up some slides.
Hey.
Well, Mark, man, I want to thank you again so much for speaking with me on our Coolest Conversations today.
Cool. Hey, thank you for having me.
We're going to take a listen now to "Can't Help Thinking About Me." It's David Bowie off the album Toy as part of the Brilliant Adventures box set here in the midst of David Bowie Week under the Stevens Underground Garage.
Western time, dances I brought the summer. My head's bound in shame, seems that I've blackened a family name. My mother says that she can't stand the neighbors talking. Gotta pack my bags, leave this home, start walking.
Can't Help Thinking About Me. That's David Bowie here in Little Stevens Underground Garage with some of the 2001 version of his 60s single that's included on the Toy album, now available as part of the box set Brilliant Adventure 1992 to 2001. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to producer Mark Platty for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. And join me next time when my guest will be Mickey Lee, younger brother of Joey Ramone, who fronts Mickey Lee's Mutated Music. And they've got a new digital single available now from Wicked Cool Records called No Fun Anymore. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Check for Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, hello, check one Tampa, check two Tampa. I need some more on one.
Okay.
Casino, check, check. Hard Rock, Tampa, check, check. Seminole Hard Rock.
Check it out for yourself at SeminoleHardRock.com. All right, guys, I'm rolling. Let's kick it.